My name's Nat. I live in Cupertino, California, and I'm a cartographer and or a designer or an artist. The first map I made, I was probably 11 years old, and it was a map of my maternal grandfather's farm, which is just outside of Athens, Georgia, in the United States. It was a cow farm, a dairy farm, primarily comprised of cows. Pastures had various structures, a couple of lakes, and a friend of mine spent a few days there kind of exploring. It was just such a, it felt like such a huge landscape, and so much that we felt like it would be a fun project to map it.
And did that stick with you? Like you continued making maps or just picked it up professionally later?
Yeah, I think I was very drawn to maps as a kid. I thought it was just very interesting that whenever I would see a map, I was kind of drawn to the fact that someone had created an abstracted, reduced version of the world using, you know, like some sort of visual language. Color meant something, typography meant something, or typographic properties. And there was a lot of information embedded into this kind of reduced, abstracted representation of the world that I was kind of seeing in real life as well. And as a kid, I loved drawing. I took a lot of drawing classes. So yeah, I was drawn to it at an early age. And the process of creating has kind of stuck with me ever since I was a little kid.
And were the maps you were drawn to, like roadmaps, topos, illustrated?
The maps that I was exposed to as a kid were primarily roadmaps, or a kind of common story in the United States is like the kids, you know, with the family on family vacation, kind of enamored with navigation, kind of road atlas books, just kind of flipping through pages. I think, you know, it was interesting as an artifact of representation. It was interesting as kind of a graphic language. And then also just as a way to explore and learn about places. I think also, like, in addition to being drawn to the creative process and making things, I've always been drawn to learning about places in the world and people that live elsewhere in the world. It probably wasn't until I got into more formal studies of music and architecture and urban design where I was exposed to different types of mappings and maps. So yeah, those formative years were more or less roadmaps.
Architecture, that's been a theme on these interviews. Alex Hotchin and Kirsten Sparrenborg started as architectural illustrators before making maps. Did you do any of that or study architecture?
I did, yeah. I studied architecture for 3 semesters and then dropped out of school. It was there where I kind of got my first exposure to producing lots of maps and diagrams. You know, after dropping out, I worked in the field of architecture and urban design in a professional context for about 4 to 5 years, mostly kind of focused on graphic design, or the graphic design that's kind of required for a lot of presentations and projects. And yeah, like was required to make a lot of maps, city plans, site plans, a lot of diagrams. And yeah, it's kind of where I learned a lot of just the making skills, applications that cartographers commonly use, both graphic and GIS software. I should also note that before that, I studied music composition, and I don't know if I was aware of it at the time or not, but a lot of the compositions I was writing and experimenting with in terms of how I notated them were very much map-like. I was very much drawn to mid-20th century contemporary classical music, and a lot of composers I was listening to, like Yannis Xenakis and John Cage, when they went to write or notate their scores, they often used methods rather, like other than traditional music notation to kind of express to other to the performers, you know, how to play these pieces, and they very much look like maps. I was also writing a lot of sound installations that involved walking through cities, recording sounds, and drawing maps of those routes and producing map books that participants, listeners, the audience could kind of sit and kind of read and view the maps while listening to the field recordings as they were being projected in space.
The sound installations were for your job or something on your own?
Oh, that was for my own. Yeah, they were in gallery spaces and spaces that were constructed for the purposes of the installation, renting trailer cargo containers that like are on trains and that 18-wheel trucks carry. Like we would rent those and have them like drop them off in a vacant site, and then we would install things in them and, you know, have an event for a night or a weekend, and then that was it.
Where was this? What city?
That one happened in Atlanta, Georgia.
And when you created the music, I'm not a musician, so I'm coming at this blind. Would you play your instrument, write down a novel notation, or would you start with the page and think, oh, how is this going to influence my playing?
At the time, it was probably more interesting for me to start with the graphic annotation, you know, with I guess the prompt of like, let's annotate something and respond to it musically or through sound.
And was this just you, or you had other bandmates?
Sometimes, yeah, just me. I studied the acoustic bass. So these were solo, like contrabass pieces. Some were computer generated pieces, and some, yeah, were with like larger ensembles.
Do you still make these?
I don't, no. I guess my life could be reduced to a series of obsessions. And this was just one obsession that I burned right through.
You find something to bite down on, perfect it, and then get sick of it, start anew?
Yes, in so many words. Well, as things have changed in my life, I've been able to sit with things for longer through a combination of like experience and growing patience. Yeah, I found that like sitting with things longer is more, I don't know, I've just found more pleasure in it. Whereas before, yeah, I would just get into it and get bored and didn't want to wait around for something else to happen. There's also something like when you get into something initially, there's just like a feeling I get, like it's this new thing. Maybe that's just me becoming less immature.
Yeah, when you just start something, you haven't found any corners yet. There's so much possibility. So you were making maps professionally for architecture and urban design, illustrative, large scale, show cityscapes, and I'm assuming development plots. And did you continue with those?
Yes. So around 2008, I was working for an architectural firm. The global financial crisis hit. I was trying to make the decision whether or not to return to architectural school and get a master's, or should I go freelance? Because I was kind of realizing that it wasn't the architecture that I was drawn to. It was more of the map making and the making of charts and diagrams. And perhaps if I went freelance, I could work with people other than just urban designers and architects for the production of these maps and charts. I'd say for about 5 years, I kind of just worked as a freelance graphic designer, trying to find projects that involved maps, the making of maps, and would really just work with anyone. This was also the time that I met Jamie Allen, who was the founder of the Scroll Census. Yeah, I was just kind of looking for any project, any people to collaborate with and find some sort of cartographic challenge. The counting of squirrels in our neighborhood and getting, you know, obtaining that data, I just thought was a great opportunity to make a map and some visualizations.
I would love as long an end-to-end on the squirrel census map as you could give me.
I was living in the Inman Park neighborhood of Atlanta, Georgia at the time, and there was a neighborhood spot, like a sandwich place that had a ping pong table, and I would go there and eat sandwiches and play ping pong, and I met this guy, Jamie, there, and we were talking. He told me about this short story that he was writing about his dog and squirrels. The research that he was doing for the story required him to have a ballpark sense of like how many squirrels live in Atlanta, called the city of Atlanta to ask them. They kind of laughed at him. He also laughed at them because he thought that they should know. He called various universities in town, and he just thought it was kind of funny that no one knew how many squirrels lived in the city. And so he just took it upon himself to maybe start planning like a citywide squirrel census. And knowing that I was into map making and visualizing information, asked if I wanted to be part of it. At the time I was looking for, you know, projects that involved making maps, and just thought it was kind of a cool idea. And so a small little project team emerged, comprised of, you know, people that work for the Fish and Wildlife Service of the U.S., epidemiologists who focus on small mammals and squirrels, a couple of artists and designers, writers. We decided to just count the neighborhood that we lived in, as a citywide census would probably be too big for us. And so we conducted two censuses in our neighborhood, and then we did a third census in Central Park. We weren't sure if we wanted to do anything after the two neighborhood censuses, but we decided it would be fun to do something a little bit bigger at a larger scale in perhaps another city. Me and other kind of project member or team members have relationships with the city of New York, and I've always wanted to draw a map of Central Park. And so, that project happened, and it'd probably be good to talk a little bit more about just that census. So the Squirrel Census is a multimedia science design and storytelling project focusing on the Eastern gray squirrel. The team counts squirrels and present findings to the public. And in October of 2018, the Squirrel Census did a count in Central Park, tallying all the squirrels. Also collected was information on how humans were using the park. I think some of my favorite parts of that project are the stories and anecdotes of what people were doing during the days that we were counting. And yeah, we presented our findings at like a party and presentation in New York in June of 2019 and released the census report. It's comprised of like two maps and a book and various other things. There's like a 45 vinyl record, some postcards.
Were you out there with the notepad tallying, or Jamie handed you his spreadsheet and you went to town?
Let's see, I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. I would go up to New York as much as I could, and I would walk around the park drawing it, sketching. Well, it wasn't my first experience doing this, but my first experience in a long time drawing a map with no map data from other sources. So just kind of starting with a blank sheet and drawing the map. It took a lot of just site visits, taking a lot of photographs. I did end up using some satellite imagery for reference, and I looked at a lot of other maps for reference. I think once I started getting into Adobe Illustrator, I used satellite imagery to kind of get some broad kind of reference points and like a grid setup. But then after that, it was more or less just drawing it based on the sketches from the site visits. I remember it being critical to get the roads right. I think that was one of my first things. It was like an attempt to lay out the road foundation and kind of have that be to scale and drawn accurately to the map scale I was working at. The roads in Central Park have a lot of detail in terms of road width and medians and different materials that are used. I did a lot of sketches on those. And then there's a lot of just like small little spots in the park that have a lot of detail. And so there'd be a lot of sketches that kind of capture detail there. I think I was definitely sketching in a way that I could embed in the sketch, like all the information in terms of dimensions that I would probably need once I got back to my computer and started drawing them. So they maybe looked very much like as much like a construction document as possible, so that like whenever I would get around to drawing it on in Illustrator, I had those kind of numbers or spatial relationships kind of notated.
As in a line perpendicular to a road saying 20 feet, 15 feet, this used trail is 2 feet wide.
Right, exactly.
And that's what stood out to me about the map is how precise it is with the, I guess, the transport layer. This is an underpass for this path, and everything's annotated so precisely. Here's an asphalt road, here's a walking path, bike path, and here's where people just stomp on the grass and make their own. So that was all started with essentially ground truthing. You walked around, logged it, and then got back to your computer to formalize it.
Yes, that was the process. I will say that for the two large maps that are part of the report, I did end up using some building data from NYC Open Data. That map layer was kind of changed and edited a little bit, but I didn't draw everything.
But for the buildings in the park, I noticed that you had historical footprints. Was that from notes too? Like, oh, there's a foundation here. What was here?
The historical footprints, those are reference from just older maps of the park. I kind of investigated all of the maps I could find of the park. That involved going to kind of like online map library catalogs, going to the New York Public Library Midtown location, map library room, and kind of checking out maps there. And just seeing, like what have other people done in terms of representing this park? A few maps do exist that have reference to older structures. I think in some of the map works of Egbert Vila, who is a prominent engineer in New York City, some of his work has information on those buildings.
And in your research, looking at older maps of Central Park, did you come across one that struck you as, oh, this is my archetype. I want to make it look like this?
That's a great question. Did I have a favorite? There were a few. On one of my visits to New York, I heard of an Egbert Vila map of Central Park that was hanging in the City Archives office, which is just north of City Hall in Lower Manhattan. And so I went and visited. It's a large map. I think it's about 12 feet by 5 feet. It's basically a survey of the grounds of Central Park before it was a park. It was done by Vila for his proposal for designing the park. Obviously, he wasn't chosen. Box and Olmsted were, but the map also had a story. So I think it was like a few nights prior to when Vila was going to give this presentation to the city of New York. He had a party at his home, and he kind of like laid out this large kind of survey map, kind of very quickly taught the partygoers, like, hey, like, I need you to help out here. I want you to annotate like all of the trees, and here's how I want you to draw them. So, and here's where you draw them. So draw them, and like you, this person, draw this kind of layer, and here's how I want you to draw it. I liked that story, and I liked the physical scale of this map. So I think that was a favorite. Vila also made a map called the Sanitary and Topographical Map of the City and Island of New York. And this isn't specific to Central Park, but obviously it's on it. And that's always been a favorite kind of Manhattan map of mine. We also looked at a lot of maps that were made throughout the construction process that the team of Vox and Olmsted generated, kind of showing, I guess, those that they reported to, kind of like, hey, here's the progress that has been happening, and here's like the upcoming phases that will be starting on these dates. Those were quite interesting. There's also a more kind of contemporary map that was made, I think, in the mid 90s, 1990s, by George Colbert and Günter Wollat, but I really appreciated precision at which that map was drawn and all the information. I think in terms of like style and aesthetics, there were a lot of maps made probably like just after the park had opened in the late 19th century, probably going into the early 20th century, just kind of a lot of maybe for the purposes of tourism or, you know, visiting the park, a lot of maps made of Central Park. They just kind of had like a nice style to them. I think we were definitely interested in kind of finding kind of certain kind of graphic styles. And if we found something that we really liked, kind of seeing how we could incorporate those in a contemporary way into the maps that we were making.
Did you go into your, I guess, road survey with these historical examples in mind, or did you collect first and then think about the aesthetics?
The research on maps of Central Park and working on the, or surveying the park, were kind of two separate projects in my head, kind of running in parallel.
When it came down to actually sit down in Illustrator and start, what was your step zero? Like, what was the first thing laid down?
It was a few things. Figuring out the size of the sheet that these would be printed at. Like, do we have an opinion on how big we want these maps? Because that would inform the level of detail, which would inform all the sketching and the information required to capture throughout the survey. And we kind of had a general sense that we wanted these to be about 5 feet in length. And then laying out the sheet size, laying out the grid of the park, using satellite imagery to kind of ensure the best that I could, like the accuracy of the scale, and the road layer was kind of the first one. In addition to the roads, I'd say the water bodies were another kind of important one. The reservoir, the lake, the pond, Harlem Mere. I feel like once kind of like the center lines of the roads and the outlines of the water bodies and just the overall grid. And when I say grid, I'm referring to a hectare grid. Once all of that was kind of figured out, I felt like the map was kind of ready for any and all detail that we wanted to put into it.
Was that similar for 2016 and 2012? Did you start with the transport and then have a parallel, I guess, aesthetic survey of older maps and then lay it down?
For 2012 and 16, it was a very different process. I was utilizing map geometries that I was obtaining from the GIS department of the city of Atlanta. I would basically just be getting files that I would open in Illustrator, and all the work was kind of done for me. Because the neighborhood that we were living in was going through a lot of rapid change, some of the layers were out of date, and so I would just kind of edit some of the line work to bring the features more up to date to what the neighborhood looked like in 2012 or 2016. I hadn't gotten to the point where it was like a desirable thing to kind of not use line work that other people had generated.
The previous ones were start with someone else's GIS data, clean up, and Central Park was, I guess, outside of a lot of building footprints, start with a blank page and draw in.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And looking at more details here, did you have a reference for, say, the interiors of the Museum of Natural History and the Met? What I love about the map is I can also find where the American Wing is.
Yeah, there were site visits to those museums as well. For those footprints, I did reference the footprints that can be found on the internet. Both have these like exquisitely designed pamphlets that you obtain as a visitor when you're there in person, with, I mean, great graphic design. And I picked up those as well and kind of referenced them. But yeah, tried to kind of adhere to this approach of like, well, let's just use these for reference, but let's draw these as much as we can without just like a simple tracing of the existing floor plans.
What was the end-to-end from, say, you first set foot in the park sketching to unfolding the map?
About 2 years.
Was a lot of that in the design? Like, were you fine-tuning this for a lot of this? Or was a lot of it taken up with, like, printing hassle?
The majority of the time was spent surveying the park. The count took place in October 2018. And for the count, we needed maps as part of, like, the tally sheets that the squirrel siders took with them as they kind of went out into the park and gathered data. There was a big effort to survey the park, generate a tally, what we call like a tally map, which is basically kind of like a wireframe site plan, minimally styled, but with a lot of detail to help with like park navigation and having enough detail so that siders could kind of know where the boundaries were for the areas that they were counting in. And having enough detail so that when they saw a squirrel in the park, they could reference the map and kind of be able to locate or kind of plot their location as accurately as possible. And then there was also just a lot of graphic design in the production of the tally sheets and print production. Then after the count, there was a lot of, you know, like, hey, we have thousands of sheets of paper with, you know, handwritten data. We need to digitize this. And then there was the process of converting kind of the tally sheet map, which was kind of the wire kind of foundation of the kind of final like two maps in the report. And so working on the two reports or the two maps in the report, and then just kind of looking at the data and having the team kind of look at it and question like, well, what's interesting here? What do we want to visualize? What do we want to make for this report? The two maps in the report, the printing was a great experience. We used a printer that I've used in the past that's based in the DC area. I had already moved to California. I would send them a file, they would send me a test sheet in the mail, and we'd kind of go back and forth. I think we had like three rounds of test sheets, and then it was off to like the offset printing machines. The test prints were digital.
Am I getting this right? So when the squirrel counters were out tallying, they were holding essentially already your very detailed kind of spare map?
To count squirrels, we leveraged like an existing methodology for small mammal censuses. And the area division is a hectare grid. And so people were going out and counting hectares. And so we had tally sheets for each hectare. I don't remember how many hectares there are in Central Park. It's like 340 something. And so each hectare had kind of a unique sheet that had that hectare map on it. The tally map basically had all of the detail that the finished kind of report maps have, but was basically just like a wireframe, kind of just black and white, no color, with the hopes that like it's kind of like a neutral kind of foundation for people to annotate squirrel locations on top of and annotate data on top of.
So the map was the real limiting reagent here. You needed the map to do the census.
Maps are both kind of like a tool used during the census process and also kind of a visualization tool or like a storytelling tool that helps us like after the count, you know, we use maps to kind of like present the findings of the report. Maps are also used to help us figure out how to divide and kind of like manage the counting. There are a lot of questions around just the logistics of how we were going to do this. None of the team members lived in New York and, you know, we're not made of money. Like we had to do this efficiently and in as few days as possible. And so we used maps to kind of figure out and determine like the best locations for people to meet. What's the maximum kind of walk time that we want people to have to do from their like meeting point to a hectare to count. As part of the methodology, we needed like a random distribution of hectare counting. So we had to take that into account, thinking about the logistics of how the park was going to be counted. I produced like a series of maps that helped with that as well. So yeah, I would say maps kind of are handy throughout many, many parts of counting things for us.
Was it that way in 2012 and 2016 too? Like they started with your map and went outside with it?
Yeah, for the first two censuses, we had tally sheets with maps. There's always been some sort of map that people take out there that help people find their hectare and mark squirrel locations on a map.
Did anyone come back with a tally sheet and say, oh, this was an overpass instead of an underpass?
Yes. Yeah, I think in the first two counts, there was a lot of feedback that we received that informed the tally sheets of the Central Park count. The feedback was, so the tally maps were basically just like capturing a grid in a much larger map. And sometimes people would receive a grid cell, which was the area that they were counting, and there would be a road going through that. But like the road label was in another cell. And when we made the Central Park tally sheets, we had to make separate label layers for the tally sheet so that we could make sure that, you know, like a road that goes through many cells, there's a road label for each grid cell, for example.
And was there any automated way of chopping up all these tally sheets, or did you draw the master and then like, okay, I'm going to export 300 little chunks?
There was an automated way to export the small cell, like individual grid cells. And I just kind of found like, it's probably not the best way, but through some best practices of file management and some batch automation in Adobe, like was able to figure out a workflow that wasn't too painful.
After this, do you have another 1,000-yard project? Like, oh, another 2 years of walking and mapping.
I would say for the last few years, I've been researching the Arctic and producing charts and maps that are about many things in the Arctic. They all more or less look at Arctic-wide kind of systems versus more kind of local narratives. I think that came out of an interest or a realization that I know nothing about the Arctic, and it would be fun to learn more. And I think just a way that I learn in life is to draw things. And then I've been doing some research on all the places that Ludwig van Beethoven lived in Vienna, and have some ideas for a map there. And then I find myself becoming more interested in walking. You know, this is kind of related to some projects in my past with sound and walking, but I would like to go on very long walks and map them in some way. In terms of how to map them, I think that would become clear to me once I started walking. I think the process would be you do the walk, and then the walk reveals something, and then you depict that and represent it, and then you present it. And so I've been thinking about taking a walk from Zurich to Lake Como, or walking from Basel to the North Sea and along the Rhine. These projects would obviously take time, and like, you know, I have financial responsibilities. You know, I have a son, you know, that I want to support and help as he grows. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I hope that at some point I kind of reach this, like, I have no more fear, and I start to embark on the challenge of like performing more of my own map projects.
Say I put you on sabbatical, your W-2 job forgot about you for a year. Would you chase down the Arctic map, the Beethoven map, your peripatetic Zurich to Cuomo map? Like, which one is really sticking out to you right now?
I would do a walking project. I would walk from Basel to the North Sea.
What is it about that trek?
There's something about walking along a river that, I mean, for me, it's easy to forget that rivers are pathways and ways that people have been moving through space for quite a while. You know, for me, like when I think of the European Peninsula, like I organize it or approach it thinking of different kinds of systems. Like even in the physical systems, like I'm not usually thinking about river ways, linear kind of water ways. I'm thinking about more mountains or. And so I think it would be a way for me to kind of connect to older ways of how people walk and probably still do walk. I'm just not aware of that. It would be a process of learning things about the world and about myself. I guess in general, I'm drawn to the idea of doing something without really knowing why or like with a purpose. I guess the singular purpose would be like I'm going to walk X, like from this point to this point. But in terms of like what I would be creating and why I would be creating it, that would be kind of revealed once the process has started. And I'm drawn to that, making the meaning within the process as opposed to before.
You don't know what it's going to look like until you start, or you're halfway through, or you're 99% done, or until you finish, and then a year later you let it cook.
Yes.
Do you know any people who sell their work or sell their maps? Like they eat what they kill? They just, sell their stuff? Because as you said earlier, man, I wish I could just put out my own shingle.
I don't. I would love to meet and talk with other cartographers that just kind of sell their own stuff and work on their own projects. I mean, I have a little bit of experience doing freelance work, and I mean, it is a bit of a grind. And for me, it was kind of balancing like client work and my own projects. But yeah, I'd be curious to know, like, are there cartographers out there that are, applying for grants or like artist residencies? Are there cartographers that are getting funding to like go to some place for 6 months and kind of work on a project? Are there artists that are, showing in galleries? I mean, there's a few people that I'm like aware of in Europe that are in kind of doing things like this. I mean, it seems like they're also teaching. I don't know, like maybe it'd be good for me to start seeking these people out and learning from them.
You don't want to be an eat what you kill cartographer. You want to write 600 words, get 15,000 euros. They give you a garret somewhere in Switzerland, and whatever comes out the other end gets put in a polished concrete floor gallery.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Yes, I would like to do that. So I've been talking a little bit about like specific projects, but I think another thing that I'm interested in is different ways of representing. And I think digital map making is very interesting, and there's a lot to be explored there. And then there's all sorts of like printing methods that I would like to learn more about and experiment with. Like I've been doing a lot of pen plot maps with the pen plotter I have here. I would really like to learn more about stone engraving. Like I was reading about how the Romans would produce stone engraved maps that they would just place out in the public realm. Members of the public, they would just show up with like a scroll and they would make an etching, and then they would have a map that they could take with them. Like that to me, it, like that is rich. Like there's so much that could be explored there and kind of like interpreted in like a contemporary way and made into a very interesting art project.
Map materials have become so impoverished over the past 300 years. Maps used to involve like, okay, here's stone, here's a brass plate, here's a silver plate, here's lithography. And now it's either screen, paper, nothing in between. And there's a little more materiality, like people will CNC mill a piece of wood, or I've been to places where there's like a cast bronze topo map, put your hands on it. But there's a lot of room left for other materials. That's what's been so fun about these interviews, is talking to people who make stuff. And like, I know a guy who presses maps into copper and leather, real stuff that you wouldn't want to touch. I'm going to look up that Roman take a rubbing yourself map, because that's a civic good right there.
Yeah, I think I read it in reference to the Peutinger table, which is the map scroll of the Roman road network. I would say one of the most impactful maps I've ever seen. I seem to be drawn to maps that have a timeless quality. Like this one is an example. There are elements of the map that you can identify that place it in time. But most of the map to me, I could easily see someone making this today. And so time gets a little bit fuzzy.
Is this the map that's super long?
It is, yeah. Yeah, it's a super long map.
Okay, I've seen that before. I love that map. It kind of reminds me of, let's say, a subway map. The geography can be wildly distorted to just show me the edges and the nodes, the roads and the towns, because that's what I care about. Traveling on a road is essentially a one-dimensional project. You go backwards or forwards.
Mm-hmm.
I love it as an artifact of craft, an artifact of navigation. And we need more like this. No reason not to. Do you want to talk about the celestial? We've discussed the light time one.
Sure. Yeah, so when making the two maps that are part of the report, we were looking at how census reports usually have a map of the area that the census, and then other maps that have visual overlays of the data. And so we wanted to take kind of a similar approach, have a map of the park and then a map of all the squirrel data. What emerged was a conceptual framework that had kind of the park map be the terrestrial map and a map of the earth and of the human experience, and then a celestial map or chart that was a map of the sky and of the squirrel galaxy. Yeah, we saw once we kind of plotted all the squirrel locations and started visualizing some of the data that we captured, it very much looked like constellations in the sky. And we've always been fans of celestial charts from older atlases, European atlases. Yeah, we're starting to see a lot of contemporary map makers and artists kind of make celestial charts, and thought it was cool that other people were kind of drawn to this. I just wanted to give you something about the conceptual framework of why they're styled the way that they are. Yeah, so the celestial map did have, unique or different challenges than the terrestrial map. It was, taking not all, but some of the map layers so that there was some sort of park spatial context that could be used when looking at kind of the data that was being printed on top, and styling that kind of contextual information in such a way where it was very much pushed to the background to leave as much space as possible for the squirrel data. And then, yeah, styling that or those layers, as vibrantly and prominently as possible. We could have iterated on this map infinitely. We had a lot of ideas, but it was kind of getting to the point where we had no more time and we made something very quickly, which was great and refreshing. Sometimes, having limited amount of time is very liberating.
Yeah, nothing like a deadline to make it good enough. Problem solved.
Yeah. There was the tally map that was made for the count, which was a significant kind of cartographic endeavor for this project. There were the two maps that are part of the final report. That was a significant kind of cartographic endeavor. But then there was this map that I made that was part of the marketing endeavors to try to get volunteers to help count. And for this one map, I had 45 minutes to make it. I think it might be my favorite map that I made for this project. Yeah, it's just okay, well, let's make something in an hour and that's what it is. And then you just move on with your life. Yeah, sometimes I work like that and what comes out is very mediocre, but occasionally the stars align and something comes out that's really, really great.
Are there any cartographers living or dead that people should check out?
I go through phases where all it seems I can do is look at maps, and I go through other periods where I don't look at anything, and I'm kind of in a period where I'm not looking at anything. I'd say for the last few years, I've been following Use Grutens, out of Amsterdam. He does a lot of just book design, but those books often include beautiful diagrams and maps. Yeah, I'm quite drawn to his work. This person, Irene Strakuzy, she does kind of map installation projects. She did one where she visualized like a whole bunch of Alibaba data onto a globe. It was on a physical globe and it was like an inflatable globe, like a big balloon, but like a really big one. It's probably like 15 feet high or like 3 meters high, or sorry, 5 meters high. And yeah, just like conceptually very interesting work. I feel like with both Irene and Joost Gruyten's, like, although he does a lot of like print work, he's also quite interested in map projects that, you know, aren't print or digital. They're more kind of like physical installations that you kind of inhabit. And I don't know, it's something that we were talking about earlier. Like, there are other ways to depict space and think about maps that go beyond just digital and print. So those are two people. Do you know Joost Gruyten's?
Yes, he came up in another interview. Oh, I love that guy's work.
I've been meaning to contact him. It seems like he's been relatively successful in doing what he wants to do.
Thanks so much, Nat, and have a wonderful California day.
Yeah, thanks, Evan. Talk to you soon. Bye.
To see Nat's work, visit thesquirrelcensus.com. For show notes and bonus content, visit veryexpensivemaps.com. This episode is brought to you by The Map Consultancy, supplier of professional, data-driven maps for your decks, reports, walls, and events. Visit themapconsultancy.com to see what good maps can do for you. I'm Evan Applegate, I'm a cartographer, and you should make your own maps.
No one wants to see dull, ugly maps. If you want to get through to your customers, you need the best cartography money can buy. The Map Consultancy will create maps with your data and your branding, PowerPoint decks, annual reports, conferences and events, your office walls. The Map Consultancy does it all. Visit themapconsultancy.com and get the best maps today.